Welcome to another edition of The Spirit Revolution. My name is Philip Coppins, and Kathleen unfortunately can't be with us today, but we do have another very special guest for us, and I would sometimes call them repeat offenders, but in this case they are repeat visitors. The lovely Frank Joseph is back because he has been hard at work at another book. His most recent one is editing The Lost Worlds of Ancient America, subtitled Compelling Evidence of Ancient Immigrants, Lost Technologies, and Places of Power. And just before July the 4th, what better way to celebrate America? But Frank, America, the way it is and the way we quite often report it is completely different.
Yes, it is, Philip. Thank you very much for the opportunity to be on your wonderful show. And I'm very grateful for the chance to discuss this work that you've been involved in for a very long time. And I just want to express to you my admiration for your contribution to alternative thought that has reached so many millions of people. And so I feel I'm in some pretty good company here tonight.
Well, thank you. You have been the editor-in-chief of Ancient American, one of those leading magazines who has been trying to change our perspective. And what you have just said, the same back at you.
Well, thank you. I feel very honored by that. Well, the book that I worked on, I enjoyed very much. Lost Worlds of Ancient America is a collection of what I feel represents some of the most persuasive evidence for the visitation of overseas visitors to North America hundreds and thousands of years before Columbus. And what I did is I went back over hundreds of issues of Ancient American magazine, which has been published, my friend Wayne May, he's the publisher, I was the editor-in-chief of that for 17 years. We put together this magazine in 1993, and it's the only one of its kind that I know of. It's been in constant publication ever since that time. It's a pretty good little magazine. And its main focus is to discuss this very idea. Was America completely sealed off from the outside world until Columbus discovered it in 1492, or were there influences from outside? That's the basic premise of the magazine. And in doing so, we were able to attract some really excellent authors and writing contributors. Some of them are university-trained scholars, are mainstream archaeologists even, and others are just ordinary folks who are farmers and homeowners who sometimes come across some very bizarre artifacts that they're willing to share with us. And that's what the book is. It's a collection of what I feel represents some of the most credible evidence, physical and cultural. And we can start any place you want.
Well, first of all, let's start with a dedication, because you've dedicated it to Fred Ritholm, a man who might not be that famous, but a man I had the pleasure of knowing on the very old Spirit Revolution archives available on BBS Radio. You can actually listen to an interview I did with Fred several years ago.
That's precious. That's great that you did that. That's so valuable and will have more value in years to come.
Well, because he was a phenomenal man. He, I think, you know, as I said, he wasn't necessarily a famous person. He wrote a number of books, but all of them almost self-published. But he was a man who basically was unrelenting in his quest to find out mysteries which were local to him and which he then began to realize were quite typical for America. And I think his lifetime pretty much illustrates this move from being confronted with an America which has very ancient monuments on its land, but really very few people knowing about them or understanding them. And today, where we're beginning to understand and where we're beginning to see that America wasn't isolated at all, and also that America, when I say pristine, with that I mean, you know, that there was an ancient and, to a large extent, a lost civilization there when basically Columbus arrived.
Well, I'm so glad that you mentioned Fred Ritholm. His case is particularly interesting because Fred was born and raised in Michigan, and he was a school teacher. He was a very honored school teacher for a number of years. And he taught grammar school, high school, and I believe junior college. And in the process of teaching the history of his state of Michigan, he came into conflict with his fellow teachers because he learned that there was an enormous, unbelievable copper mining enterprise that erupted throughout the northern shores of Michigan along Lake Superior. This copper mining enterprise began about 5,000 years ago. To give our audience some idea how long ago 5,000 years ago is, that's when Egypt was new. The very first dynasties were beginning to flourish. That's when the Sumerian civilization was just really getting underway as a literate civilization. And yet 5,000 years ago at that time, there was this gigantic mining enterprise. We know that there were a minimum of 5,000 pit mines that were excavated actually in a quite sophisticated manner that extracted a minimum of 250 billion pounds of the world's highest grade copper, and that copper vanished. It disappeared. At the same time that mining was going on, the New Age of the Bronze Age erupted in Europe and the Near East. Well, when Fred Ridholm learned about this, he had to learn about it outside of his profession, he was very disturbed that this information was not conveyed to students. He thought it was incredibly important. And he devoted his life, which was very long. He passed away only a few years ago. I believe he was well into his 80s. He devoted his long life to making this tremendous discovery known to as many people as possible, because mainstream archaeologists, the writers of our textbooks, do not discuss this. They will not. It is not discussed. Whenever the mining is ever mentioned, if they're actually cornered about it, they'll say, the Indians did it. Well, the Indians didn't do it, because the Indians themselves say that a white-skinned people, we're talking specifically about the Menominee Indians, have a tradition about a light-skinned people who crossed the seas. They're referred to as the marine men, or the sea people, that crossed the seas, and in their version of events, wounded Mother Earth by extracting her shiny bones. This is a poetic metaphor for copper miners, obviously. And this is why we wanted to dedicate The Lost Worlds of Ancient America to Fred Ridholm, who did so much to popularizing this idea, and thanks to him, it is known to more people than it would be otherwise. We do talk about the copper mining a little bit in our book, but mostly it's a very broad spectrum. We talk about hard physical evidence, about the Kensington Rune Stone that was found and verified. We talk about the Bat Creek Stone found in eastern Tennessee. It's a Hebrew inscription from the 1st or 2nd century A.D. that has been absolutely authenticated by top geologists. And this information is not available for the most part on television, hardly at all. It certainly is not at all taught in schools. And that's why we feel that this book has some level of significance.
And when I say that the book is all over, I mean in the sense that it is all over America, because you are not limiting yourself to the United States, but you really go from the bottom to the top of this American continent and really find that there is so much more to it that is not commonly talked about. And some of it is what I would call detail. You go into the history of finding certain coins which clearly show something is going on. Things which you wouldn't, or which history has, official history has an easy way of dismissing, of saying, oh well, there are a few coins. But taken together, they are, you know, part of a larger perspective that this is a continent which has been visited from not just Europe but from several areas. Now, you have, you know, 45 entries in this book. Out of those 45, what are your favorites, and also what are the best available evidence that really shows Columbus isn't the first?
That's a very difficult question, Philip, because I really enjoy them all. One of the articles that I really enjoyed is, I don't hold on to sound like an egotist here, it's my own, but it's on a subject that I knew very little about, and I was given the opportunity by Ancient American to research something that I was with which I was not that familiar. I'm referring to the stone spheres of Costa Rica. And I had heard about them, but I didn't know much about them. The reason why I mention them is because they represent a high level of technology that goes back thousands of years to a totally unknown people. And you're absolutely right. It would be wrong to restrict a book of this nature for political reasons to just the United States. So we talk about Brazil and Costa Rica and Canada and so forth, and we don't make any political distinctions at all, of course. Those are just lines on the map as far as we're concerned. When we talk about America, we mean all the way from Alaska and Canada down to Tierra del Fuego and all the countries in between. But I specifically mentioned the mysterious stone spheres of Costa Rica because it's something that, as I investigated, really shocked me. I was absolutely surprised. I learned that these stone spheres were first found as recently as 1940, so it doesn't represent a very ancient discovery at all. In 1940, there was a U.S. company, a plantation, that was clearing the jungle in Costa Rica in an area that had never been inhabited. Archaeologists had gone in ahead of the company to make sure that there were no Maya ruins or Mayan artifacts of any kind that might be disturbed. And after the archaeologists had gone through the area and says, no, there's no sign of any habitation here whatsoever, the clearing of the jungle began. And as they did so, within a few days, the operators of the bulldozers unearthed what looked like the top of a large ball sticking out of the soil. So they dug further and they excavated what amounted to a stone sphere, a perfect ball made of solid granite, weighs 6 to 7 tons all the way through, and it is carved with a perfection which challenges stone cutting abilities today. This stone sphere, which weighs, like I say, about 7 or 8 tons, I guess. I don't have the book in front of me, but if you read it, you can tell. It's about 7 or 8 tons. It's carved within a perfection of 1.005 inches. Now, if you were to go with, a 10-ton slab of granite and ask a stone cutter, say, I would like to have a stone sphere cut with within the perfection of 0.005 inches, you know, he would consider that a challenge, if not an impossibility. No one understands what the purpose of this stone sphere was. And over time, and even up to today, more and more of these stone spheres have been recovered. All of them have been buried, either deliberately or through the natural process of deposition, across Costa Rica. Archaeologists have been able to determine that the type of granite material that goes into these stones is not native to the immediate area, that it was quarried on the other side of the mountains that divide Costa Rica. So that either the spheres were made on the other side of these mountains and then somehow transported, for whatever reason we don't know, to the other side, or else the granite was hauled up on the other side of the mountains and brought over and carved there. Very laborious. Also, some of these stone spheres that weigh many tons have been found on islands, several islands off the coast of Costa Rica. Some of these islands are as far as 9 miles out at sea. Can you imagine the type of a vessel that would be necessary to transport several 6 to 9 ton stones? You're talking about more than a birch bark canoe or hollowed out log. You're talking about a real ship, a freighter that's able to carry this type of load. So far, about 300 of these stone spheres have been found. About a dozen of them have been broken in half. Sometimes they've been blown apart with dynamite caps to determine what's inside. They are all uniformly solid all the way through. There's nothing inside them. There are no inscriptions on them, nothing of any kind. And the only indication that they were used in some way is that one group of them was found in a formation, a kind of a chevron. It was thought then that there might be some kind of astronomical orientation that they were involved in. That turned out not to be the case. Besides that, a sphere does not lend itself to an indicator of any kind. The only other stone spheres that have been found, one has been found, strangely enough, off the coast of Haiti on a small islet. One was found there. A number of stone balls, a few of them much smaller, have also been found on the other side of the world, of all places, in Troy, amongst the ruins of Troy. And you can go to the Çanakkale Museum in Turkey and visit these stone spheres, as I did about 15 years ago. Why these stone balls were made, for what purpose, no one knows. The only thing we can construe is that Costa Rica is one of the most seismically active places on Earth. It is the most seismically active area in all the Americas. And perhaps there is some kind of a relationship between the high technology that was able to craft so masterfully these stone spheres and the earthquake activity there. This is a radical conclusion, but nonetheless, we do have the physical evidence of these spheres themselves. They are not Mayan. They're not associated culturally with the Maya at all. There is no way to date them. If they were buried deliberately, then some of their dates with their organic material found goes back to about 2,000 or more years. If, however, they were buried through deposition, natural processes, they go back many thousands of years. Archaeologists are unsure whether they were buried naturally or buried deliberately. But although these spheres represent a very high enigma, they do show us unequivocally that some high culture in the Americas was able to achieve a level of stone carving that was beyond anything else known in the ancient times, and that represents a very sophisticated way of thought that was surprising.
Absolutely, and I have seen some of those stone spheres in another place, in Bosnia, just outside of Zenica, for people who are going to go in September to the Bosnian Pyramid Conference on the Sunday, I believe, of the conference. We will actually be going there. And there again, you have them. They're slightly smaller than the Costa Rica ones. But
really?
But
stone spheres in Bosnia? Are they? This is totally new to me. I've never heard of this before. And are these about the same size as the ones in Costa Rica?
They're slightly smaller, but then again, the Costa Rica ones vary in sizes as well.
Yes, they do. They vary in size from about the size of a basketball up to about 6 feet, 7 feet in diameter.
Yeah, I mean, they are not that small and not that big, so to speak, but they're all located in one single valley, and it is believed that they were buried as well, and that they were dislodged through either the activity of an earthquake and or basically erosion, which basically loosened them up and made them come down. And in the village just outside of Zenica, actually the locals at one point in the past took one of these balls and made it into a fountain feature. But the rest of them are still in situ and are being discussed. But everywhere, I think, these stones are escaping the attention, and the skeptics basically point to a place in New Zealand and say, look, you see, they are natural there, so by default, all of these other ones have to be natural as well. It's once again this quick attitude of dismissing things.
Yes, it is. Yeah. It's different with Costa Rica because a number of the stone spheres, tool marks have been found on them. Hello, Philip?
Yep.
Oh, okay. We're still here. I thought we were disconnected there for a minute. There have been some tool marks found on them, so no one is suggesting, at least the Costa Rican spheres, are not regarded as natural phenomena at all.
And you know, that is really the thing, I think, that we, again, individually, the skeptics will try to maintain this point of view that America is pristine in 1492, but when taken together, and when you start digging deeper, you're actually beginning to realize that's not at all the case. And one of our future guests is actually Ross Hamilton, who I believe is actually a contributor to this book as well. And he is going to delve a bit deeper into that. But there is, the book contains some old-time favorites, what I would say, things like the Kensington Stone, which has been discussed and which continues to be researched. But then there's also recent discoveries, like straight away in Chapter 1, California's Buried Altar shows you just something very recent. Could you expand a bit on that, please?
Yes, that's a tremendous find that was made just a few years ago by ordinary citizens living in Los Angeles, California, on the west coast of the United States. And they were engaged in expanding their basement. They were digging it deeper to make way for a water heater, I believe. And in the process, they found this large stone, which they dug out. It appeared square at first. And when they dug it out completely, it turned out to be a kind of a cube-shaped stone that was obviously carved. It's dark brown red stone, and it's about 4.5 feet high, excellently carved. And on one side is a human face. Well, they cleaned it off, and it turns out to be what looks like the face of a woman with a kind of a bouffant, a kind of a hairdo, a curly hairdo, and also some geometric designs on it. By the way, this would have been originally, considering the basement and so on, it would have been buried about maybe 12 feet below the surface of the earth. And they had no idea what it was. They took it to the Los Angeles Historical Museum. The Los Angeles Museum is a world-class museum. It has some of the greatest archaeological collections about the Americas anywhere. And the archaeologists there were kind enough to actually examine this object in an unbiased way, for maybe the first time or one of the few times anyway. And they said that, they couldn't deny that it was a man-made object, but they said, this is not a modern fake. That's usually the case. When people find things like this, archaeologists will say, oh, you're trying to fool us, this is just a fake, and it gets dismissed or thrown away. In this case, though, that was not what happened. The archaeologist said, this definitely represents an ancient find of some kind, and it goes back at least 500 years. Well, when the photographs were shown to us and we got a chance ourselves personally to visit this sculpture, we found that it went back a lot further than 500 years, but it's to the credit of the archaeologist that at least they said it was authentic. We were also able to identify the image that's portrayed on this object, and we're able to identify the object itself. The object itself is known as a tophet, T-O-P-H-E-T. That is a Phoenician altar stone. It's a kind of a sacrificial altar stone, but it is used in religious service. It was used in religious services by the Phoenicians. The Phoenicians, for those of our listeners not familiar with who these people were, they were a very great seafaring people who, after the fall of the Late Bronze Age, we're talking about maybe 1200 BC, they were people that lived in the Near East, like around Lebanon, who became very great seafarers, who colonized much of the Mediterranean, and are known to have voyaged out into the Atlantic Ocean. That is given by mainstream scholars. They know for sure that the Phoenicians traveled very far. We know that the Phoenicians completed the first known circumnavigation of Africa in 600 BC. That also is known and pretty well accepted. However, not well accepted is the fact that the Phoenicians visited the Americas. Well, there's indication that perhaps they went as far as California, as hard as that is to believe. The face that is portrayed on this tophet belongs to Astarte. And we know that because we have found a number of Phoenician representations of their goddess Astarte, A-S-H-T-A-R-T, Astarte. She was, among her other duties, she was the patroness of sailors, of mariners. And that would be very proper, of course, for a Phoenician who has traveled all the way as far as California to have created this altar stone in dedication to Astarte. The provenance of this find is beyond question. Even the conventional archaeologists admit that. And the identity of this stone, its connection with the Phoenicians, who began sailing around the world 1,200 years ago, is also beyond question. That's why we included that one. First off, there's really no debate about this. Unfortunately, this find, even though it still exists, has not changed any of the textbooks. You will not read that yes, the Phoenicians were definitely here in the Americas before Columbus, thousands of years before even Spain came into existence, modern Spain. But nonetheless, it is a hard evidence that the Phoenicians were here. The descendants of the Phoenicians still exist. They are the Lebanese people. The Lebanese people, a DNA survey was done on the peoples of Lebanon, and they connect very closely with Phoenician remains. That the Phoenicians existed really pretty into modern times as a people anyway, all the way up to about 800 AD, before they were finally completely left history. But the Lebanese people are direct descendants of the modern-day Phoenicians.
And it's I think the stone actually begins to show maybe a change in attitude from the scientific establishment. As you said, no textbooks have been affected yet, but they might too soon. Is there a pattern? Because the standard perspective, specifically amongst alternative researchers, is very much that up until relatively recently, if not right now, most scientists in America will say that there is nothing to it, and will also point to specifically the Smithsonian as an oppressor of the truth, that sometimes artifacts have disappeared, whether they are giant human skulls, whether they are pieces of artifacts of a lost civilization. Is that general attitude correct? And has it always been like that? And what are some of the motifs behind it?
It has not always been like that, Philip. American archaeology began really in the, I would say, with Thomas Jefferson, who was probably our greatest president, certainly in terms of intellect, very brilliant man, a Renaissance man in every sense of the word. And he was a true scientific archaeologist. He kept a very open mind on possibilities or influences from other parts of the world. And that liberal attitude appertained throughout the rest of the 19th century, when American archaeologists, who were known primarily as antiquarians, wrote some really wonderful books, which are no longer in print and no longer in circulation, unfortunately, that talked about the possibilities of visitors from elsewhere. And they relied rather heavily on Native American traditions about fair-skinned people that came from overseas, and dark-skinned people, too, that came and had a very important impact on pre-Columbian America. However, right around the turn of the 20th century, there was a man by the name of John Wesley Powell. And John Wesley Powell was a great man and an evil man. He was a great man in the sense that he brought scientific discipline to archaeology. He applied scientific principles to it to turn it into a real science. And to his credit, he did that. That was good. However, in laying down the tenets of modern American archaeology, he decreed, he ordained, that any so-called evidence that tends to show that there were visitors to the Americas before 1492 must be assumed, he said, to be either fake or to be a misinterpretation of Native American influences. And that law, that decree, has stuck with American archaeologists ever since, and that has hobbled and crippled any interpretation, any real understanding of American prehistory ever since. And that's why it's important for books like The Lost Worlds of Ancient America to show that there is alternative. He was wrong in doing it. The reason why Powell did that is he was a religious fanatic, and he was very much opposed to what he referred to as the Mormon heresies. And so, and the Mormons, of course, part of their doctrine is that there were people here before Columbus who had some kind of an effect on Native American development. Well, his church didn't believe that, hated everything with the Mormons. And regardless of whether the Mormons are right or not, this religious controversy is at the basis. His religious prejudice and bias is really what's at the root of this idea that Columbus was the first and only one to visit the Americas, that somehow the Americas were hermetically sealed off from the rest of the world for thousands of years, and that the very notion that a people that are great enough to build the Great Pyramid, are yet not great enough to build a boat that can cross the ocean. I mean, there are many lapses in logic with this paradigm, but nonetheless, it is dominant, and it's an unfortunate thing.
Even if right next to the Great Pyramid there are boat pits with gigantic boats.
You bring that up. That's a real good parallel, yeah.
But it is one of those things, again, whereby the eyes of science are being shut to something which happened an awful long time ago. And people who are following things like archaeoastronomy, it's, you know, Otto Neugebauer, who was an Egyptologist in the 1930s, once mm-hmm. made this statement that the ancient Egyptian civilization made no contribution whatsoever to the development of civilization in any real sense, and that they were definitely not clever enough to look at the stars. And no. he then basically said which stars they knew about and which stars they didn't. And Egyptology ever since is stuck with that. So like 10 to 15 years ago, when Robert Bovell began to speak about his theories mm-hmm. About the Orion correlation theory, mm-hmm. Egyptologists really went back to the 1930s, whereby they realized, you know, what Neugebauer had said. And because they haven't been told, because they haven't learned, because it's not part of their education, they just will basically shout everybody down because they have no idea of understanding. But the ancient America is definitely ancient. You know, when you start looking at Peru and corralled and the pyramids there, you are all of a sudden 3,200 BC. You're at a time which is older than the Great Pyramids. We kind of like, I think, are getting around slowly to seeing that America was contacted. We interviewed a few months ago Gavin Menzies about some of his books, and definitely in 1421 mm-hmm. and 1434, mm-hmm. He's making the argument about a Chinese contact. Mm-hmm. But what's the picture like across America? Because there are some artificial boundaries thrown up there as well, in the sense that in the south you had the Incas, in the middle you had the Mayan civilization, and then in the north, oh wait, we haven't really ever thought about that, but there are remains about some mounds there. There's obviously still an awful lot of work to be done into mapping the United States. And before we put the picture of a pan-continental civilization, if there is one or isn't there, on the table, how do we bring about the various bits in the current United States, the mound culture, artifacts found everywhere else in America?
Well, that's a very interesting point of view. And the reason I think why you see these divisions between North, Central, and South America is because there were major physical boundaries, natural boundaries that separated them. You had the Rio Grande River, for example, that today separates Mexico from the United States. We now know that the Rio Grande River in the past was a far more larger raging river than it is today. So it created a very natural boundary. You have the Andes Mountains that certainly serve as a boundary for the development of Andean civilization. And it would appear that these different cultures developed differently because they were separated by very great distances, and there were formidable natural obstacles in between. That's the same thing in Europe. You had the Pyrenees Mountains dividing Spain from France. And today, although it doesn't mean anything because you can fly over them, but in the ancient past it was more significant than today. England was isolated as an island and so forth. And I think the same basic natural divisions existed in the Americas that they exist now. What's specifically, though, people are aware of things going on in Peru, of course. Machu Picchu is world famous, and the pyramids of Mexico, of course, are world famous. And far less known, and tragically, are the four high civilizations that rose and fell in what is today the United States. We're talking about North America, north of the Rio Grande. But there were four that were able to actually define, four high civilizations that for hundreds of years, sometimes thousands of years, were able to assert themselves and make a tremendous contribution to mankind, and they vanished away. This is something that even mainstream archaeologists know about. They've known about them for very long time, since the 19th century, but they're not discussed. They're not their existence, their very former existence, is not made available to ordinary people. And these four civilizations are really worth discussing. The first one, I won't go through all four, but I'll just mention the first one because it's cited in our book, The Lost Worlds of Ancient America, to some degree. And that is referred to as the Edina civilization, and it was a civilization. Before 3,000 years ago, the population of what is now the United States was made up mostly of hunter-gatherers, as it had been since the end of the last ice age. There were no cities, not much for villages even at all. People were always on the move. They were following the seasons. They were hunter-gatherers. They were materially low-level society. That does not mean that they were worthless society. They were a very valuable people, agricultural people. But in terms of a high civilization, no, they were not. 3,000 years ago, all of a sudden, a new people arrived that archaeologists refer to as the Edina. That is an archaeological word just because it's named after a plantation on which the first of their mounds was found. And the Edina were the introducers of agriculture. Before them, there had been no organized agriculture in North America. They are the introducers of ironworks. They had iron foundries that flourished throughout the Ohio Valley. There's still hundreds of them, at least dozens of them, that are found all throughout Ohio, specifically in the Ohio Valley. They created incredibly beautiful stone pyramids, not just mounds of earth. There is a mound called Grave Creek Mound in western Virginia. It was a work of landscape art that was a mound, for sure, but then was plated with stone blocks, and a huge moat was dug around the circumference of this mound. The moat itself was 15 feet deep and something like 25 feet in width. So it was kind of like a reflective pool. These people, known as the Edina, their real name was something like Allegheny or a leg. That name Allegheny is known in the United States. It's an Ojibwa word. Allegheny means, in Ojibwa, the people of the mountains. Because eventually, at first these people, they landed on the eastern seaboard of the United States in New England area, and then they moved into what is now the Allegheny Mountains, and then eventually settled, this is about a little less than 3,000 years ago, in the Ohio Valley. And they're referred to by the Ojibwa as the Yom Kodesh. And Yom Kodesh translates in English as the red-haired giant sorcerers. And they're described as people of extremely tall, robust stature, who, although outnumbered by Native Americans, asserted themselves because of their advanced technology and their superior physical strength. And they appertained in North America from about 3,000 years ago until the 8th century. That long, they lasted that long. These people's development, called the Edina or the Allegheny, parallels exactly the Celts of Western Europe, that their burial tombs, their burial sites, are virtually identical to the Celtic burial sites that are found, for example, at Salzkammergut in Austria. In Salzkammergut, there is a very well-preserved Celtic burial, which was made up of logs intermixed with gravel. It's a short, rectangular feature. The corpse was laid out. A slightly roofed structure was made, and then the mound was made over it. You find this fingerprint building style of the Celts found in no other place in the world except in the Ohio Valley associated with the Allegheny. 3,000 years ago is also the time of great Celtic dispersion, the migration that went all through Western Europe, and eventually they came into contact in a very destructive way with the Roman Empire. And what we believe is that through these battles with Rome, and even before them, before Rome really rose to fight them, you had these waves of Celtic seafarers that crossed the ocean and established themselves in the Americas. I think that if I was in a court of law and I was arguing the case for Celts in America, I could confidently come in with a guilty verdict on that. So here we have a very important, it's more than a theory, Philip. I mean, when you compare the Celts of Western Europe with the Yom Kodesh or the Allegheny, the very first civilizers who introduced agriculture and ironworking here, the parallels are so close. They're so close that I think that they're really beyond question. And as far as being giants, in fact, they were. There's a very brilliant scholar by the name of Dragoo, who wrote a book in the early 1990s about the excavation of some of these so-called Adena mounds, where the Allegheny were interred. And they found the remains, the skeletal remains, very well preserved, of a man who was 7 feet 2 inches tall. At first it was found, well, the bones just appear that way because of disarticulation over time. That theory was completely debunked. Especially when the skull of this man was retrieved, and it was about 1.5 times larger than the skull of a normal man. Since then, Adena mounds have been opened up all across Ohio, Pennsylvania, West Virginia, and they have revealed about a dozen, at least a dozen, that I'm aware of skeletal remains of the Adena. Some of them are well above 7 feet tall. The largest one known, verified, is 7 feet 8 inches tall. These people were not deformed. They did not suffer from some type of serious metabolic imbalance. They were robust. They were strong all the way to the top. The tallest Allegheny woman ever found, it was also in the Ohio Valley. She is 6 feet 9 inches tall. It's remarkable. And yet it has not filtered into the textbooks. You don't hear about this race of Celtic giants that brought civilization first to North America. Don't hear anything about that. And that's why we have to write these books, because otherwise they're just forgotten.
Absolutely, and there is so much being forgotten, and you really, I think, on a number of occasions, not merely try to push things out, but also are preserving it for posterity. Because you were already saying that some of these books of people who have been doing these explorations in past centuries are out, going out of print and really disappearing. When it comes to Middle and South America, two known civilizations, the Mayan, the Incas, well studied by archaeologists, are the archaeologists right when it comes to their timing, by the extent of these civilizations, or do you feel that there are still hidden dimensions or dimensions to these civilizations which need to be further underlined, if not exposed?
Well, I should make it clear that I have a great deal of respect for mainstream archaeologists. I think the difference between themselves and us is that it's a different point of view. Mainstream archaeologists are very subjective in their work. They look at their artifacts very closely. They do very valuable work. Without that, it would be impossible for us to put together our own work. They are known as cultural isolationists because they look very closely at something. They don't see it within the context of something outside of the immediate environment. Whereas myself and others, my colleagues, we are cultural diffusionists, which means that we take an objective view of these things. So when we see an enigma like these ironworks that are found in Ohio, and we find the introduction of agriculture, we don't just say, we can't understand why this suddenly happened here. We pull back. We try to look at the picture in the context of what was going on elsewhere in the world. And that's when I think the answers begin to collate. And the future of archaeology, I believe, I pray, is that it's a closer relationship, a friendly relationship between the university-trained archaeologists who look very closely at these things and learn a lot of information about them, and the cultural diffusionist, who is sometimes university-trained and sometimes not, who is able to stand back and to see it within a larger context. There needs to be a dialogue between the two. I think that the archaeologists, even the most hidebound conventional archaeologists, would agree that, in fact, there still are many great things yet to be found, and that time parameters and chronologies are constantly being affected. We know, for example, that the radiocarbon dating system is not as infallible as it was once believed. It's still a very useful tool. But it has to be used in connection with other dating techniques to come across a more credible dating system, a dating period for what you're looking at. So I hope that that level of cooperation develops in the future.
And what time frame are we talking about? Because this idea that Columbus discovered basically something which, you know, was virgin soil, is still there. How long do you think we will have to live with this, and what does it take to change the paradigm?
Well, what it takes to change the paradigm is for these men to die off. I don't mean they should be executed or anything. Sometimes feel that way, but no, they just need to pass away so that a younger generation who is more appreciative of the possibilities of cultural diffusion and diffusionism needs to come on board. And I see that actually happening. I see that taking place. An example of that is a gentleman by the name of Michael D. Coe, C-O-E. And Michael Coe is one of the most important archaeologists of the 20th century. He was able to identify the Olmecs as the oldest known civilizers in the Americas. He became the doyen of Olmec studies. The Olmec, for our listeners not familiar with them, they were the first known true civilized people in the Americas. They began on the east coast of Mexico around Veracruz. They erected conical pyramids. They did very beautiful jade work. They appear to have some kind of a written language which hasn't been entirely deciphered yet. And they did many, many great things culturally. And during his time in the 20th century, Michael Coe towed the line. He was a mainstream archaeologist. And after he retired, and he didn't have to worry about tenure anymore, he came out in the open and said, yes, there have been influences from Indonesia in the ancient Americas. I couldn't say this while I was active because I would have been savaged by my colleagues. But now that I'm old and retired, I can get away with it. He actually refers to a kind of an academic mafia, that's his term, not mine, in which he says that this mafia determines what is discussed and what is not. And if it's not, if you want to bring up something that is outside of the paradigm, you're going to be marginalized out of your profession. That actually happens. People, we can cite several rather tragic examples of professionals who have brought up the wrong type of evidence and have stuck by their guns. And as a consequence, the good old boy club got them fired, and where they've been reduced from being university-trained professional scientists to doing things like selling flowers on the street. That actually has happened. People have no idea of the incredible cultural criminality that is taking place in American science today. And that's exactly what it is. The suppression of evidence, the ruining of careers and reputations that take place. It's a tragic state of affairs, but it's something that needs to be addressed, that's for sure.
Absolutely. And, you know, for a leading scientist to speak out like that, How much longer? How much time before these people will die off?
Well, in the course of time, I guess, Philip. You know, I don't know. I as I gaze into my crystal ball here, I'm assured that it will happen. That's all we need to know, is that the world is changing for the better. That's all we need to know. We don't need to know when. It's God's time, not our time, I suppose. All we have to do is just keep doing the best. You just keep doing those great shows on television. God, they're so exciting. You make such a wonderful presentation. Keep that up. Every time, every word you utter is another artillery barrage against the ivory tower, you know. So that's great. Keep doing what you're doing, you know. We'll see.
Rather than Battle Los Angeles, it's Battle Archaeology. And there is a section in the book, and you've sort of touched upon it already somewhat, but also lost technology. This is not just a lost civilization, but it was also evidence of lost technology. How advanced were these civilizations? What's the kind of technology which archaeology or has been uncovered through the process? How far, you know, do we have to go as far as spaceships, or do we just have to say that they were slightly more developed than archaeologists are giving them credit for?
Well, I think we would be enormously shocked to see the level of technology that was achieved by ancient American civilizations. I mean, the introduction of iron foundries 3,000 years ago, that's pretty good, but that really is hardly anything compared to some of the material that is being found now. I think we would be really shocked if we knew. We are only beginning to get glimpses of what these ancient cultures were able to achieve. And I'm referring to especially the Incas in this case. There's a site which you probably have visited. It's called Sacsayhuaman. It's in Peru. And when I saw that place for the first time in 1994, it's a life-changing experience. You're looking at these stones, some of them weigh as much as 16 tons or more, that are fitted together in these series of walls. Beautiful. Who would think that a stone wall would be a work of art, really a beautiful work of art? And they're fitted together like a great jigsaw puzzle. And when you realize that these stones, weighing numerous tons, have been fitted together without any mortar, and that at a height of between 10 and 11,000 feet above sea level, where you can barely breathe, you can barely walk, trying to organize a society to build something like this, what kind of technology was of it? I don't care what kind of manpower you have. It doesn't work. To be able to fit these stones together with such incredible precision, I greatly doubt that if you hired a construction company to go up into the height of the Rocky Mountains and say, I want you to reproduce Sacsayhuaman up here, you know, they think you were nuts, as he couldn't do it. And yet it was done so many centuries ago. The reason why those stones were made that way was revealed to me by an old tour guide when I visited there. And after his retirement, he shared some of his stories. And the most remarkable story he told me was when he visited Machu Picchu, and the stonework there is identical to the stonework at Sacsayhuaman. We have these enormous stones fitted together like great puzzles without any mortar. They're just linked together. And the native term for Machu Picchu just means the high peak, the tall place. But the native Aymara word for Machu Picchu in English is the place of the dancing stones, or the place of the dancing walls. Nobody knew what that exactly meant, because they had dances there or something, but that's what it's still referred to by the native people, the place of the dancing walls or the dancing stones. And the old tour guide told me that back in 1976, one of his last tours, he was showing a number of foreign visitors, tourists around inside Machu Picchu when a sizable earthquake took place. Well, they're not rare, of course, in the Andes. They happen all the time. This was a pretty sized earthquake. And he says, yes, he was afraid, but then he thought, well, what a more beautiful place to die. He says, if I'm going to die here, that's fine. And that thought made him very calm. And as he was standing in the middle of Machu Picchu, of course, all the tourists are running around screaming and not knowing what to do. Nothing you can do, of course. And the ground is swaying beneath your feet. And he says it was quite terrifying. The mountaintops were swaying back and forth like pinwheels. And he calmly looked around at the walls of Machu Picchu. And the stones were sliding back and forth on each other. They were dancing during this earthquake. The earthquake was not throwing them down. The earthquake was moving them in sequence together. And when the earthquake stopped, at that very moment, all the walls, all the stones in the wall came back to their original positions. Not one stone was out of place. And that means that that site, Machu Picchu, and that construction was made deliberately by the Incas or people before them to go with earthquake movement. They are earthquake-proof walls. That's the reason why those walls have stood up for many hundreds of years. Any other building, well, the buildings, as you know, in Peru, they've almost all of them have been knocked down from time to time. Not the old Inca buildings, because their stones have been engineered as earthquake, I'd call them resistant, earthquake cooperative. Well, that's a technology that we don't have. We could certainly use that. And that was a remarkable story. And every time I look at Sacsahuaman and places like that, I figure, yeah, that's right. That's why those things are made that way. They're made to give. They're made to move. That's why they're not mortared. If they were mortared, they'd all splinter apart. They'd all fall down. And they don't. They stand. Remarkable. That's just part of this is the iceberg's tip of the technology that these great people possessed. I think we would be enormously shocked if we could stroll through Cozumel or through Cuzco 800 years ago and see what that place looked like. We'd be amazed.
Absolutely. And what you have done is do an amazing job with the Lost Worlds of Ancient America. There are far more bits and pieces of great knowledge to be relearned, recovered, or just found out for the first time. It's edited by Frank Joseph, our guest today. Frank, what is next for you?
Well, my next thing is I completed a book called Before Atlantis. It deals with human evolution and the very beginnings of human civilization, which I feel go back to about 75 to 80,000 years ago. And it centers around the eruption of a volcano called Mount Toba, which was the greatest volcanic eruption in all known Earth history. And that's what that book is dealing with. That should be out next spring sometime. I'll be sure you get a complimentary copy of that the moment that it comes out.
And we would love to have you, as usual, on our show when that becomes available, because already I can smell that it's going to be good. So thank you, Frank, for being our guest today. The book is The Lost Worlds of Ancient America, edited by Frank Joseph. If you want to listen to this interview again, you can do so in a number of ways. You can go to our website, thespiritrevolution.com. You can listen there to the last 5 shows, but you can also see an overview of some of the guests we have had in the past, including some older interviews with Frank, which occurred last year. If you want to listen to more than a year of interviews, you can go to iTunes and basically click on The Spirit Revolution, or rather type in The Spirit Revolution, and that'll bring up the Spirit Revolution for you. You can go to Facebook, facebook.com/Spirit Revolution. You can always listen to the last show there as well. If you want to familiarize yourself with all of our shows, you can go to BBS Radio Archive at bbsradio.com. There, for a small fee, you can listen not just to our shows, but to all shows which are aired on the BBS Radio Network, both Channel 1 and Channel 2. Until today, we are still one day away from Independence Day in America, so enjoy your Independence Day tomorrow. From Kathleen and myself, the truth against the world is our rallying cry, as always. Until next time, from the both of us, goodbye.